둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell.
Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from County Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season four. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
There is a podcast that is a world unto itself.
A podcast as boundless as space and as timeless as infinity.
It is the place between light and shadow.
Science and superstition.
You've entered
the fifth dimension.
The latest series from the Consequence Podcast Network will open the door into Jordan Peele's new revival of The Twilight Zone, and it will go as far as the limits of the mind itself. Subscribe to The Fifth Dimension.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. You can always subscribe to the series wherever you get your favorite podcasts from, like iTunes and Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube and Spotify. Put out interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at Consequence of Sound. I'm Kyle Meredith. It's another special episode for a lost friend. May is Mental Health Month, as you may have heard. And while it's always been very important, it seems to be even more so in the conversation lately. And that's a good thing. More people are hearing about it. It's also, unfortunately, more in the conversation because we've lost some great artists, and some of those are friends in the past few years, artists that have meant the world to me personally. Last week, I ran an interview with my friend, the late Scott Hutchinson of Frightened Rabbits, who died by suicide just last year. Similarly, an artist who I really account for changing my life, and I'll get to that story in a moment, but talking about Chris Cornell, also died by suicide on May 18th, 2017. This is the second year anniversary of Chris leaving us. And so much like the episode with Scott, I wanted to compile a couple of the interviews that I'd done with Chris. One, to keep the conversation of mental health going as a way that I can contribute to that conversation. And also to celebrate the life and the music of one of the greatest musicians of all time. However they leave us, whenever they go, it's important that we remember them and we celebrate them when we can. And so all of that's going into this episode with two interviews that I recorded with Chris Cornell. One from December 8th, 2011 on the Songbook Tour, and another one on October 27, 2015 on the Higher Truth Tour. Now, for me, Chris Cornell is probably more important in my life than any other artist because of how his music affected me. I grew up in a very small rural town in Kentucky, Litchfield, Kentucky. One high school, one middle school, and no rock stations. We had top 40 stations and lots of country stations. And that's what was offered to me, and some oldies stations as well. Thank goodness for those. We did have MTV, but for some reason that hadn't really penetrated into my consciousness at that point in that way. So I was just raised on a steady diet of what top 40 and country radio had given to me. And then one day in eighth grade, a friend of mine named Kim came up behind me and just without saying anything, put a pair of headphones over my ears and said, "You have to hear this." And it was Soundgarden. It was the Super Unknown record, and it was a song called Spoon Man. And it changed my life in that moment. Everything about where I am today and where I am right now is because of that song and that album. And I rushed out to buy it at the local Walmart in Litchfield, and I didn't stop playing it for months. And it scared me. It scared me because the music was dark and it was heavy and the artwork seemed almost demonic. And I thought maybe I'm doing something wrong, which made it really, really exciting. The music was so powerful. I mean, when that guitar part starts with Black Hole Sun, that is everything right there. And then you fast forward to when I went to college. And I went to college for basically a semester at Eastern Kentucky University. And while I was there in 1999, Chris Cornell put out his first solo record, Euphoria Morning. And there was a college TV network called Channel One. It's where Anderson Cooper got his start. But I remember that they would play music videos in between news segments. And Can't Change Me was one of the ones they had in rotation at that point. And of course, I was already such a big fan. And so here I am in this new phase in my life. And once again, it's Chris Cornell that is soundtracking that. And I could go on and go on and go on and tell a story for every single Chris Cornell associated record that he put out through the entire time. But it's all to say how much I admire and appreciate and would like to honor this artist, again, in one of the only ways that I can right here. So it's a very long intro, and now we're going to get into it. So this is a two-part. The first one, again, December 8th, 2011, Chris Cornell was right here in Louisville, Kentucky, playing at the Brown Theater. He was on the Songbook Tour, and we talked about what that had been like, you know, this acoustic tour that was gone. We talked about Soundgarden and his thoughts on the band eventually getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which needs to still happen. He told me some Temple of the Dog stories, and we even talked about his first solo show that he could remember, which is really interesting. I'd never heard that story before. Chris's first solo show that happened pre-Soundgarden. So that's what we're going to get this in on. Part one of Kyle Meredith with Chris Cornell.
Backstage, Chris Cornell. Sir, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Well, you just you came in, you've been on tour, the solo acoustic tour the whole time. How's it been going this time around?
It's been really good. It's been great, yeah. It's actually been going on a while now. One tour just kind of blends into another. So I did the first one and then toured with Soundgarden in the summer for a while and then kind of went straight back to this, went to Australia and then South America and doing this acoustic tour, you know, kind of finishing up the U.S. The first one, it was 25 shows. That's actually not very many when in the U.S., you know, there's a lot of places to go.
Yeah, well, I guess you've been used to, especially with the Soundgarden days. I mean, you guys would do, what, 70 dates?
Yeah, like per record, we could do that many in the U.S. alone, easy, yeah.
That's got to be nuts. I mean, that's a long time. And, of course, you've been conditioned. You've been at this a little while now, but...
It seemed like a really long time then. Now it's just sort of, it's my life, kind of, you know.
You're coming up on a big birthday here in a few years.
Which one?
You're coming up on the 50th birthday.
Yeah, that's far away though, I think.
Yeah. Well, it could be far away, but as you get into this, I mean, rock and roll has proved itself now, definitely. But being a guy who's in the 40s, you're going to hit 50s, and you're still the big rock guy. I mean, how do you see that that position?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's easier to see from a distance, easier if you're looking at somebody else, and you have a sort of place in your mind where you can put everything. And for me, I have never been very good at including myself in that perspective. So I don't really bother trying.
So age is never a factor?
No, it doesn't really. It doesn't make sense to me. I participate without really making much of an attempt at figuring out how I fit. Because it's really difficult to have a perspective on it. And you know, there's lots of different examples of how other people feel about individuals in music and what their contributions mean. And time is kind of the yardstick that I go by. So the one conviction I have is that I'm lucky, and you know, the bands that I've worked with over the years, we're all lucky because our music has seemed to last this far, and that's good. Other than that, you know, as to what it really means, or rock music in general, or pop culture, or you know, any kind of culture, I think the meaning changes depending on when you're asking the questions.
It's interesting that you said you talk about the contributions and what it means to rock. It's been a debate with me and my friends about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Some people are so against it, they just think it's unneeded. You guys seem like it's going to be, you know, one day you're going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, Soundgarden has contributed that. Do you have an opinion?
Well, I don't know. The people that I know in music that get excited about it are almost always also critical of it in some way or another, and it gets a little bit confusing. For me, it's kind of simple in that it seems like something that has normally been associated with sports. And there's a lot of musicians that are sports fans, and they can kind of relate to it that way. I don't really relate to it that way, but also I think if it were a process that were more kind of open, as opposed to a panel or a jury that decides who gets included, then maybe I would be less critical of it. But to me, that just rock music and a panel or jury deciding things about it and what it means, and that doesn't make any sense. So I've never really thought much of it.
It's not very rock and roll, actually, when you put it that way, is it?
It's not very rock and roll at all. But then you have these moments like the Tom Hanks produced Rock and Roll Hall of Fame HBO special, which was great, and that makes somebody like me feel happy that it's there, because then an event like that can take place and you can see all these people coming up and performing music, and for whatever reason there seem to be a lot of really amazing performances, and that's something I can get behind, because it's something that's almost more fan driven and good for fans to be able to see, and it's more celebratory. And one of the complaints that everybody I know has had from the beginning of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is that the ceremonies are sort of cheaply done and unceremonious, I've never seen one that was compelling or exciting or amazing or seemed celebratory or, you know, had anything to do with the vitality that these different musicians came from or created. But you know, one person took great pains to explain to me that how it was all for the fans, and that I should be excited about it because my fans will be happy to see me inducted. And that you can't argue with. If it makes fans happy, then I think it's a good thing.
You're, of course, I mean, everybody always likes to point out that iconic voice that you've been able to hold on to all these years. And it is. It's sounding, I think, more amazing than maybe ever. How are you keeping it? Do you have to keep it in shape, or is this just something you've been kind of blessed with?
There's, I guess, certain things you learn over time that are probably different for everybody, like things you can do and not do, and timing, you know, and when you can do and not do those things, and how far can you really push it, and in what way. And then all of those rules kind of change as you get older, because your vocal cords, which are, it's really like a fleshy disc with a slit down the middle that's about the size of a quarter, and they change as you get older, and so you have to kind of relearn. It's a strange thing, and then through that you sort of have to forget everything, because really it's just an instrument that should be something that is kind of available to be used as an instrument to convey whatever you want to emotionally. And that's impossible to do if you're worried about what it can do in terms of scales and notes and timbre and whatever else. So the probably the best and most important thing I learned is not to worry about it too much.
So has there ever been that spot where you've thought back on a few of your older songs, Nothing to Say, Birth Ritual, and you went, man, I wish I hadn't written that so high. I've got to go out and do that.
You know, there's a couple songs that I lobbied to never have released just because I sang them so high because it sounded silly to me. And I think there was a period in my career where I did that just because there didn't seem to be a ceiling. You know, I just kept going higher and higher and higher. And at some point it reached a level where it just didn't sound like anything other than, you know, helium. It just seemed silly. And at that point I started backing off that. So I think through Soundgarden's last two records and past that, I started to kind of calm down on the range. And then I noticed after doing that for like 6 or 8 years or something that I couldn't sing those songs as easily. But then getting back into singing some of the songs with a higher range, I got all of that range back. It was sort of how I got it in the first place, was just doing it.
Right.
I wasn't born with a high range. I mean, it's a little out of what would naturally be there for me, but I figured out how to do it. But I don't know that it's important. I think, in a sense, it's something that I became known for accidentally. It wasn't something that I wanted to be known for. And to me, it's what's always been the most important thing is it interesting in whatever range it's in? And I think the other problem that it creates having the ability to have that range is when it came to songwriting, and still even now, I spend a little more time focusing on what register I'm singing in now, but I used to never even think about it. I just had a melody idea for the song, and whatever key the song was in and started out in would just stay that way, and then if it was hard to sing, it was hard to sing. I think about that more now, mainly because I think the song is the most important thing, and being able to kind of connect with it emotionally is the most important thing in the song, and to just grab a melody in any register and sing it, you're sort of a little bit at the mercy of whatever the key of the song started in.
It's interesting, of course, to hear you go back and talk about all these different stages of your career. Are you able to look back on that as a yearbook? I mean, when you look at this stuff, when you're singing certain songs, is that still certain points of your life that you keep having to relive and relive and relive?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like a time machine, because I don't think of it as years gone by. Like if I'm singing a song like Soundgarden, just spent a lot of time kind of relearning a large part of our catalog. So we were going back and listening to old recordings, and I was physically trying to play and sing the songs at the same time. Some of the guitar parts are really hard to sing over, you know, and suddenly it was just like, you know, I remembered every little thought and emotion I had about it the first time it was written and the first time I heard it and tried to sing and play it. It's all like right there. It's like it happened the day before, you know. And the good thing about that is that I have this sort of clear vision of what those thoughts and feelings and obstacles were, and I can kind of continue to solve the puzzles and the problems that came along with all of that. You know, always trying to evolve in terms of where the song goes in the context of a live performance.
So is Soundgarden now your focus for 2012?
Probably for a lot of it, yeah. We're trying to finish up an album, and then, you know, we'll be touring to support it. The first thing that happens in my life in 2012 is touring with Soundgarden in Australia. So
it's nice to get down there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was just there, but I can't wait to go back. And it's I also want to play more shows with Soundgarden because, you know, for some reason, I'm not really sure why. Maybe it's because we were so eclectic. I still feel like there's some better version of me as the singer and guitar player, you know, that my contribution in that band, there's still some sort of better version of that as a live musician and performer. Not so much performer in that, you know, I can think of something else to do as a performer, but just in terms of the music and performing it and where it can go. I feel like there's something else I can bring to it that's better than I ever have. And the only way to do that is to actually get out there and really do it and find that, whatever it is.
Yeah, I guess I'd read in an interview, maybe the Rolling Stone interview, where you guys were saying, like, this is, we're picking up right where we left off, too. So, you know, as far as what people are looking forward to, you know, what's the record going to sound like, that whole thing? I mean, is that accurate?
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, the problem is that when you say something like that, it can lead anybody to believe what you're saying is it will sound like we sounded on our last album. But the thing is, we never really did that from one album to the next, even if two albums came out in 1 year. So when I think of what the next logical step would be, or picking up where we left off, that type of perspective, it includes some type of musical evolution that it would have included anyway. And the only thing that's not completely in sync with it could have been a 2-year break or a 15-year break is just that I think, you know, we all bring considerable amount of experience back into the studio and into songwriting and arranging. And I think there's less less sort of self-conscious perspective, because we were a different band even in 1996. You know, we were a band that sort of existed within a world of other bands, and that was kind of considered to be part of a genre, in a sense, that was almost more geographically definable than musically definable. But and there was also, like, you know, this strong current sort of commercial rock marketplace that our record label considered us to be competitive players in. And now we're at a different place where we're sort of in a genre of one, and, you know, we don't have competitors. We just are who we are and have been accepted as that. And that kind of, that changes a lot. I don't know that it necessarily adds a lot more confidence, but there's less distraction.
It's got to be nice, actually, to see all the fans. I mean, it's not even the fans. I think the critics are going crazy, like, wow, it's actually going to happen. This is happening.
Yeah, they're just sitting there like they can't wait to listen to it and then try to sort of take it apart and put it back together and then decide what it's going to mean 10 years from now. Now.
Yeah, right. and you're to a point in your career now, too, where you kind of—I don't know—it seems like you would get to have your cake and eat it too. You can be a solo artist, you can be in a band, and you don't have to ever choose. I mean, you go back and forth.
Well, yeah, I mean that started out that way in a sense. I started playing guitar and bass right around the time Soundgarden formed, and up till then I was a drummer and I sang, but I had never actually sang in a band. I would just sing backups and stuff, and pretty much right away, songwriting became a focus, and it was never about actually being able to play an instrument well. It was about being able to use it to create music. And I started doing that a lot with Soundgarden and then simultaneously just on my own for fun. And that never stopped. So that was always there. So, you know, I did a few different things outside of Soundgarden. But I remember when Temple of the Dog came out, I had different people telling me, wow, we're really surprised that you could sing like that or write songs like that. And I always took it negatively. And I also always took it like, you know, I didn't understand why. Why would they not think that I was capable of something different than they'd already heard? And then a few years went by and I started to sort of understand it. Like, why would they? If they haven't heard it, then maybe they wouldn't know. But to me, I was always, everyone in my band always felt that I was capable of doing anything I wanted. And I was always encouraged by everyone in my band, always. But it just was, it was something that was more personal and not something until Temple of the Dog, I suppose, that ever had a venue.
Do you remember your first solo show?
Well, I did a show with Matt Cameron and Scott Sundquist, who was the drummer in Soundgarden between me and Matt, which was about a year. And it was an acoustic show, and I played a 12-string. And I think Matt played guitar and I'm pretty sure, and Scott played percussion, and it was like an hour long or something acoustic show. I don't know why I played 12-string. It was really hard to play, and I think that in my mind was sort of what I thought of as my first solo show. And it got one write-up in like a local fanzine in Seattle, and they gave it a positive review, which I didn't agree with it because I thought that I was awful. And then I didn't do it again. And then the first solo show for Euphoria Morning, for my first solo album, I remember really well. It was in Boston, and I wasn't planning on coming out and playing really anything except for music from that album. You know, I wasn't doing what I do now. You know,
starting all over.
Yeah, completely. And it was a sold out show, and there was like one guy who was seated and kind of rowdy near the front. And, you know, I could hear him kind of yelling and being rowdy, and he was clearly someone that was a hard rock fan and a Soundgarden fan. Mm-hmm. And that was the guy I was worried about. You know, I just thought everyone else will, even if they don't like it, they'll tolerate it, but this seems like a guy that's just going to have to be heard, you know? And we came out, and he had this look of confusion for it may have been a whole song, you know, it may have been like somewhere halfway between the second song. It might have been faster, though. A look of confusion, and I think, and then the song ended, and somehow or another, he connected to it, and then he seemed so overjoyed that he could, you know, that even though it was different, he could get it. Yeah. And he stood up and just started, like, pumping his fist in the air and yelling, fuck yeah, all right, yeah, right on, you know, that kind of thing. And that was the last time I really worried about it. Because yeah. I thought, like, you know, this is going to be, in anything that I do outside of a band that had such a strong identity, some people are going to not like it as much. And other people are going to like what I do that didn't actually like that. And that's actually happened a lot. And because I've experimented with so many different things, like the album Scream has, there's fans of that album that aren't fans of anything else I've ever done, really.
Such a different record.
Yeah. And so it's, I'd sort of accepted that pretty early. Also, after Temple of the Dog, I had such a great experience with it, and it was such an eye-opening experience about how amazingly rewarding a collaboration like that could be, a quick one where there's no goal other than just enjoying playing music with people that you haven't played music with and see what comes of it, you know. And in that case, there was no goal for anyone. There was no goal for the record company. They were just trying to get through it and move on. A&M Records put out that album as a favor to me. They didn't really put anything behind it. They just wanted to get it out of the way. Until I heard it, then it was different. Mm-hmm. But it taught me to be open to collaborations that would make sense and could be exciting. And that's why Audioslave happened for me. Right. For my part, I felt like, well, you know, it just seemed to me in my mind, sort of mulling over what the possibilities could be, that it would be stupid to not at least get in a room with those guys and see what happens. And then I was pretty confident that it would, that something would come of it right away. And it did, like, I don't know if it was 40 minutes or something. You know, we started playing music. I think we wrote a whole song and maybe started another one that could easily have been finished. And that was it. I just knew that we could be great and we would make great records.
Next stage of your life right there. I'll close my Chris Cornell wish list. Reissues, eventually. A DVD. Where's the... You were on PJ20. Where's the SG30? Hopefully.
I don't know. I'm not that sure that that's important to me.
Well,
you know, I don't know. I watch not a lot of them. I watch some music documentaries, and some are really good. The two that I've seen that Scorsese did, I love. And they're very, very different than each other in terms of style. I felt like the Pearl Jam documentary was really great. You know, but it's also done by somebody that has experience in that from a teenager. But then there's like that series Behind the Music where it just seemed formulaic. And mm-hmm. I guess what I don't want is a documentary to come out that can be seen and then anybody can feel like they've taken away a clear image or perspective of what Soundgarden is about and what we experienced, because I don't think that's possible. And I don't want to limit any individual's imagination to be sort of erased and rewritten by this film that is difficult to really, in that medium, convey what it felt like or maybe what it really was. And we're so eclectic musically, I almost would prefer that a large part of it remain a mystery or have at least not be demystified incorrectly, mm-hmm. which I feel probably is what would happen with the film. It's just too literal. It's too... I probably mistakenly tried to keep film cameras away from Soundgarden all the years that we were playing live. And the main reason why is because I didn't want to ever see it. because it would replace my memory of the experience, which was always, to me, pretty crazy and ethereal and transcendent. And, you know, it's almost, you know, most of my memories of those shows are like memories you'd have of when you had a high fever or something. Mm-hmm. And I probably was an idiot to always try to kind of enforce that, because it would be nice to have a lot of that footage now. And that would probably help create some type of a documentary that, in the absence of, could make it impossible. I don't know.
Well, rock and roll has definitely lost the air of mystery, but you guys have kept that one, and it's been really nice. Chris Cornell, thank you so much.
Recorded December 8th, 2011 at the Brown Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky on the Songbook Tour, Mr. Chris Cornell. Now we'll flash forward to 2015. In fact, specifically October 27th, 2015, the album Higher Truth had just came out, and he was playing at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville. Nashville's 3 hours down the road from Louisville, so me and my videographer, Tyler Franklin, jumped in the car, headed down there to interview Chris Cornell backstage at the Ryman in the Johnny Cash room, No Pressure. So it's with that the first part of the audio you hear here, I'm so happy we captured this, is just us gabbing about setting up the equipment and the time limit that we are imposed on right here. So part two of Kyle Meredith with Chris Cornell.
It's a nice, comfortable talking situation.
Yeah. I didn't have to move.
Usually the proximity's a bit closer, but it's like, all right, yeah, it's fine. It's backstage.
Yeah, but you can be in my shot, too. Like, I can see your profile.
Oh, I'm the camera hog. I'm the interview hog. Let's be honest, this interview's about me. It's not about...
Isn't it always?
We had a long discussion about that beforehand, and no, it's not.
You did?
Yeah.
With who?
With him.
Uh-huh. You guys talked about you. See what I'm saying? Yeah, it supports my third.
Son of a bitch.
I just, that's BS. That doesn't hold water, what I just said, but...
Chris Cornell, back with a new record called Higher Truth, and it's a fantastic record.
Oh, thank you.
I think you're getting a lot of applause and accolades from this one.
Yeah, it seems very well received. Yeah. Most importantly, by fans, and I kind of felt confident about, you know, the most of the way through. You know, I felt like it was kind of born from the songbook touring, you know, the solo acoustic touring. Mm-hmm. And wanting to feel like that became such a special thing for me, and being able to do all the other things I do, especially Soundgarden, and then be able to bifurcate the time between the two, where it's two really completely opposite things, has been really a blessing. And it's you know, there's no confusion mm-hmm. for me creatively, nor for my fans. So I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make the songbook touring like a living thing, as opposed to always a look back, and wrote this album really in support of that.
That nostalgia, I know that can be tricky, especially for an artist who's kind of mm-hmm. so associated with an era, you know, for better or worse. Yeah. I know that's a tricky thing for the longevity of a career, that you have to, I guess you have to consciously ignore that, and you have to try to, you know, get past
I think
that.
I think there's a healthy way to do it, and then there's the sort of bully way to do it, which is you write a new album, then you go out and you tour and you refuse to play anything but that.
Oh, right.
And I think, for me anyway, my experience is that doing both is great. You know, I don't, or at least I haven't up to now believed in the idea that when people buy a ticket to see you perform, that you not give them at least a little of something that you know that they're going to want.
Right.
And I know in the context of these solo acoustic tours, because they're screaming it at me. You know, I can hear them. there are no amps to like drown it out.
I'm sure it only gets comical if they start yelling Ty Cobb or something like
well,
that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that happens, you know, every night. You know, yeah. They're yelling a song that's not going to happen. You know, it's right. Ridiculous to yell for. But I think that it's in the spirit of something good. And regardless of what I do, even during my... first songbook tours, where I was playing songs from Scream, very supportive of everything that I played, you know, it didn't matter. And on this tour, definitely, you know, supportive of the new material and happy to hear other material. So it's, you know, I feel like there's a good balance that I strike, and there's no, and there's no predicting, you know, it's once you, is you're sort of constantly infusing a tour with new material, and you're sort of opening up the ears to it. It is a living, breathing thing, and that living, breathing thing can have a history. That's right. Fine. I'm lucky that I have it, you know? So
Why don't you doing a dual thing too right now? Because Euphoria Mornings got the re-release.
Uh-huh.
That hasn't happened yet, I don't think.
It did just happen. Okay. Two weeks ago.
How on hand were you for that? Like, was this a thing where you had to listen to Euphoria Morning over again? And did that have any influence per se, like having to concentrate on that era of your life as we're talking about nostalgia?
No, the only thing it did, you know, for me was I think there was an essence of convenience to it, where the record company looked at it as, okay, we have this in our catalog, mm-hmm. and Chris is putting out a new solo album, and this is his first one, and people love it, and so we'll press it to vinyl because we never did before.
Just anything they can do. Yeah.
And I get it. You know, it's an investment they made 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's on those books from 15 years ago. Why not? You know? And people, it's actually the one thing people will buy music for is to buy it on vinyl.
I'm guilty of it. I've went looking for it already.
Yeah.
So,
I understand. And it also helped me because it's sort of, come back into discussions, particularly in chat rooms and viral stuff, which I've seen. Mm-hmm. It also gave me the opportunity to kind of adjust a couple things that I had wanted to for years. But I got to see, kind of simultaneously with the reception of Higher Truth, I got to see a lot of people talking about how important that album was for them. Yeah. And I think that all of that kind of positive energy sort of elevated everything. And so, you know, I was happy with it. I think it was a good thing for them to do.
Yeah. Well, on the subject of Higher Truth, you know, I've heard you talk about really wanting to make this a storytelling album. Mm-hmm. And I've also heard you say, and I couldn't figure out if you were being sarcastic or not, that like half the record's about your wife.
I think that half of all my records are
about
my wife. At least, you know, everyone that if I look back and kind of, it's a good 2 to 4 songs per, but a solo album, she's going to have half. And I think that my kids make it in there too, in the way that I think it's just sort of the natural course of songwriting when, you know, your life really outside of your career is your family all the time. It's gonna be what you're thinking about.
You're bringing your family into your life more and more. I mean, I saw the video of you and your daughter up there. Are both your kids like wanting to be musicians? Are they on their way to being musicians?
Both of them definitely dabble in different aspects of being musicians and being interested in music, and appear to have sort of talent in a lot of different areas. Where it's almost kind of like, well, what, you know, whatever you decide you want to do, you can do. And you know, my feeling is support them more in those areas where they want to do something.
Have you turned into the old guy who's like, damn kids and your damn music?
No,
whatever they're listening to, you know.
You know, no. I recently watched this news report on CNN about parents and their teenagers with the internet and handheld devices and different ways of communicating through the internet and social media and that kind of stuff. And what was weird is all of these parents were younger than me, and a lot of them had no knowledge of what their kids do and what music they listen to and what their social media is. And I felt like, well, I'm actually sort of all over that. And I'm all over what they do. And I'm all over what they listen to. And we're all over sort of how they interact and what they say. And I feel like I'm kind of in step with them. And I haven't really pointed them in any direction in terms of what I think they should appreciate artistically. Because I think that's a big mistake.
Sure, that's because they're rebelling against that.
You're going to get the opposite.
Like, mine's still young enough. Mine's 8, so he's like, you know, he's okay with me.
Yeah.
Kind of. I just kind of, you know, nudge it in there a little bit, you know.
The only thing I ever did was when I heard, and I don't remember what it was Pandora or Spotify or something. My son was listening to what sounded like AC/DC songs from the other room, and I thought, I was listening to AC/DC. He chose that, and I thought, that's great. And then I thought, wait a minute, that's awful. And I went and I looked, and it wasn't, because they didn't license it.
Yeah.
So it was like LA Guns or something. It was some LA rock band doing their whole catalog. And so I had an iPod full of, you know, thousands of songs, and I just gave it to him. I said,
"You gotta
listen to the right stuff." But I think you know, they exposed me to things that I otherwise would not.
Yeah.
It wouldn't come across my plate. It just wouldn't. And so I think there's an exchange that happens. And I think that for me, at least, being a musician, I can connect to almost anything. But I'm still going to have that.
Sure.
I think I have that in the context of analog music versus digital music, and performing musicians versus people performing to track and sort of ghosting their own performance on stage and all that kind of stuff. I don't get it. That doesn't draw me in. If I don't hear sort of the humanity to a performance on an album, it just doesn't draw me in.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a decision that I've made as much as it is just it's something that happens or doesn't. So I have that, you know, I have that kind of nostalgic desire to want to hear analog recorded music and live performances in a studio where you feel it from beginning to end as one performance instead of something that's been edited in a computer after the fact.
It's a lost
which
art.
By the way, I can hear that screams at me, those edits and how they're edited. And
you can hear that, you know.
Yeah,
some of us now, but I try not to get too hard on that either, because like, what was I listening to at that time that was so out of touch with you know, a purist before me or something like that?
Sure.
Like, so I'm the same way. I try not to put them down too much. I just don't listen to it myself.
Well, it's not something that's attracted me, and some, like, I remember really liking industrial music as in my late teens and early 20s, and there was something about it. It was a new kind of visceral music to me, and the content was very aggressive and kind of scary, and it was exciting. And I still think some of that music can be really exciting, and I still think that a lot of electronic music can be exciting, mm-hmm. but it's not going to beat something that I get an emotional connection with, and I'm not going to get that without sort of just hearing what feels like a person in a room or people in a room.
Sure. And I was about to say, my only argument was you put a really great vocalist on it, you know, who's really given her heart, his heart, whatever it is, and skirt that in on the electronics. Like, you can have some soul in there.
I think that that's missing. I think that people swallow the whole pill instead of just biting a piece of it off. When I was making the album with Timbaland, I was in the studio and they were going through a hard drive of a bunch of stuff that he had done. That was just catalog stuff that had never been released. And there were songs that he was singing on, and they hadn't touched his vocals or edited it at all, you know? So there, it was just really raw. And I thought that was some of the coolest sounding stuff I'd ever heard him do. And I was telling him, that is what you got to put out. And they're looking at me like I'm nuts. Because they're very much into a world of electronic post, you know, kind of has to do a certain thing. And I understand it, but it's a different world in some ways. I also think, though, that there's always scenes of purists, always. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can find that. Whatever you really want is out there.
You going to be on the campaign trail this time? I've been interested in that, to kind of see if you're going to be doing that. You did, you know, with Obama the last couple times, and I thought...
Yeah, you know, there was this... It depends. It depends on what it feels like to me. I felt like with Obama, there was a certain amount of fear in regard to like what would happen if he didn't win. You know, it felt almost like there was a damage control scenario there. And I think I am sort of in a lot of ways that's how my thinking works when it comes to politics and when it comes to elections. It's like, okay, who's going to get nominated? And then, you know, what is the sort of the lesser of two evils in a way? And
I'm not sure
I think
it's
with
looking
Obama,
much better
it was now. Very, I think it was very clear. There was no confusion in regard to that. And, you know, we'll see how things play out now. But this is not something, there's nobody that's inspiring me really.
It's pretty wacky out there.
Yeah. I also, in sort of paying attention in the last 8 years, and really focusing on how events have taken place, I feel like it's going to take a lot more than any particular administration to make any real change. And I'm not sure, you know, other than barring some sort of breakdown in how this country is run, which is probably going to have to be a financial one, that you're going to see any real effective change. I think it's this constant sort of push-me-pull-you scenario that just keeps living on, and we keep sort of scotch taping everything together, and at some point it isn't going to work.
I just think
it's
people
not
are lazy.
Hold. Yeah.
What, yeah.
I think they are too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the unfortunate thing. I really, really do love Higher Truth. I know we didn't get to talk about it as much as I wanted to, but it's a beautiful record. You've really exceeded past...
Thank you.
...all the things, so thank you.
Thank you very much. I put a lot into it. It took 2.5 years or so to write, maybe a little more.
You can tell.
Yeah. I did a lot in between then, but I think that really helped. I think that being able to take a couple months away from it while I'd be on tour with Soundgarden or touring for myself or whatever I was doing would allow me to come back with fresh ears. And it was something where I had to I had to kind of reinvent myself as a songwriter in a lot of ways to make the whole thing work.
Well, we really appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that one, again, recorded October 27th, 2015, backstage at the Ryman Auditorium for the Higher Truth Tour. This is usually where I would thank the artist, and huge thanks, the biggest thanks to Chris Cornell for the conversations, for the music, for everything. Right before Chris left us, he had just released a new single called The Promise. It was the title track, theme song to a movie of the same name. And he was in Europe, and I'd reached out to our mutual contact to say, hey, I'd love to talk to Chris again about this because it seems like a project that's really important to his to him. And Chris was up for doing it, but it was a scheduling kind of thing that we were working around because he was in Europe. And so we kept having to put it off and put it off and put it off. And then he came back to the United States, and it was in Detroit, of course, as we all know, that he died. I didn't get to talk to him again, and that's sad, but it is so much sadder for other people, for his family, for the world of music, that we lost such a powerful, powerful artist. Again, May is Mental Health Month. If you're struggling, there are numbers. There are websites. There are people that want to help. There are people that want to listen. And if it's something that you're dealing with and you're listening to this, then I hope you reach out and that you find help. Because there's someone out there that feels about you like I do about my favorite artists, like Chris Cornell. And that is where we're going to wrap this one up. I'm going to go listen to some Soundgarden. I'm probably going to put on Spoon Man. And then I'll just fall down that rabbit hole from here. That's what I do every single time. Whether or not I have the time, it's going to happen because that's what happens every single time. I hope you enjoyed the interviews. I hope you take the positive messages from this, the love that this man had for his family, and the love that this man had for his fans, the way he talks about him, as you heard. It's always so inspiring. iTunes, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, that's where you can find this series. Consequence of Sound has your music and film news, WFPK.org, where I do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern. And I'm at Twitter at Kyle Meredith and Facebook/Kyle Meredith. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right, bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.